obviously satisfied them, and they passed me, and I graduated. The reason I tell the story is because that's precisely what happened. Not hypothetical. It was the reality. When I went overseas, I went to a town called Brumath, the ship. The Ile-de-France was a famous luxury French ship that we went to. Landed in Scotland, took a train down to Southampton in England, got on a little Polish, which had escaped, a little Polish cruise ship to take us across the English Channel, landed in a place called Le Havre in northwestern France, and they call them 48s. These are trains, 48, 40 men and 8 horses. It came from World War I, that type of train. And went to be processed and so forth, and got my assignment. And it was to a division called the Texas 36th Division. It was called the Texas 36th Division because it had been originally a Texas National Guard outfit, which had been federalized in 1940, and was part of the 7th Army, which was the 36th Division, 3rd Division of the 45th. 45th was from Oklahoma. 3rd, I think, was also from Texas, division from which the great Congressional Medal of Honor, where Payne became a movie actor. Anyway, I joined the outfit, and they assigned me to the 2nd Platoon of the 2nd Battalion of the 143rd Infantry Regiment, and I was replacing a very fine, as I was told, officer who had been killed. And I went to the sergeant, who was the only one in the platoon from the original Texas outfit that invaded Anzio Beachhead and crossed the Rapido River and the Volturno River and fought its way right up through Italy and then took part in the invasion of southern France on August 15th of 1944, just a couple of months after Normandy. We hit it from the north and we came from the south. And I said to this guy, who was a survivor, never even been wounded, 2 years of combat, incredible, from Texas. And by the time I joined, there was many, not from Texas, as from Texas, it was all replacement people. They were shot up very badly in Italy, very badly. It's another line of stories. But, you know, they're not nice word, I'm sorry. This platoon sergeant said, "Lieutenant, you're fucking crazy." I said, "What do you mean? You think I would become a platoon leader? I have survived, and I'm going to go out there in front. If I can just get another few months, I know the war will be over, and I won't do it." So my effort to get somebody to continue, he said, "You got it, you do it." I said, "No, I've got to learn the ropes." So I interviewed one or two more, and I kept getting negative answers. One guy from Portland, Oregon, he said, "Oh, geez, I don't think I have that kind of leadership capacity." And then I went to the captain. I said, "I'm having trouble doing what I wanted to do. Listen to me." And he said, "You know, there's a guy coming back from the hospital today named Stone. He's had a lot of combat. Good man. Not from your platoon, from another platoon. But, you know, you might speak to him. He might be willing to come over and take charge until he's ready." His nickname was Red, Red Stull. He had red hair. I, for years, thought he was from Tennessee, but it turned out he was from Virginia. I found that out a long time later. But I spoke with him. Now, the captain said to me, "But one thing I have to be, today we would say full disclosure, I've got to tell you, he's a drinker. And he's a troublemaker when he drinks too much, so you have to be careful about that." So I went to Red Skull, introduced myself, told him what I had in mind, and he seemed to be intrigued. He was a, kind of a happy-go-lucky guy. He was a sergeant, he had a lot of combat experience. And on our first attack, after that. It was a night attack. Beautifully planned, like you see in the movies. We had aerial photographs of the German positions. We had intelligence about where their softness was and so forth. It was fantastic. And we got within 20 yards of the German position. This is a phrase called the FPL, the final protective line. And that's where you line up defensively, and you have your machine guns usually on the two flanks, and you have them zero in cross-firing, so you're making a barrier to getting into their positions with your crossfire. And that's what happened. We got within 20 yards, and we thought we were pretty good to get that close without being discovered. It was pretty amazing, about 4 in the morning, something like that. And then all hell broke loose. They, I guess, were waiting for us to get close enough. And they opened up, and we all hit it. And my plan to let somebody else be in charge stopped right there, because even though it was dark, I sensed that every eye was on me. And the words, Sir Voci, very low, "Hey, Lieutenant, what do we do now? What do we do now, Lieutenant?" And, you know, rationalizing it later, there is a tendency to hope that there'll be a leader who will tell you what to do. And so, even though I was as young as I was, even though I was letting somebody else make decisions for a while, they wanted me to make a decision. So my troubles ended there. That is to say, they were looking for somebody to make decisions, and I was up, I like to think, up to making decisions, and did. And I didn't have that kind of problem again. Sadly, Red Stahl, in a later, I had a guilty feeling for many years, but then I got over. We had another attack we were making to get to what was called the Haguenau Forest, which is in eastern France, and part of the Alsace-Lorraine. And the operation was to get in and through the Haguenau Forest, and in the northwest corner there was a city called Wissenberg, which was a French Alsatian city, but it was right on the Rhine River. And our objective was to get to the Rhine and to get across the Rhine River. And Vino Red, I said to him on this attack, I said, "Look, I know that you like booze. Officers, even in combat, when you got off the line, every month got a liquor ration. We got some Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch. We got a bottle of gin. I don't think we had any vodka. But about 4 to 6 bottles of good hooch, plus cigarettes, which I used to trade for gum because I didn't smoke at the time." But I said to Vino Red, I said, "If you will stay sober during this next operation, the next time I get my ration of liquor, it's for you, off the line." He thought that was the greatest deal he ever heard. He said, "You got a deal." In that very combat, he was hit and killed by rifle fire, a sniper actually. And I used to always think, maybe if he wasn't so sober, he wouldn't have been exposing himself the way that he was, shouting commands, hearing what I was saying, and he would repeat it for the guys on the other end. In any event, Vino Red was lost. We lost others too. Does that tie in with, oh yes, that was the experience of getting into combat, and I saw a very limited combat. I was one of those lucky people who saw enough combat to know what combat is, to know what, and to learn a lesson that I don't know others, I think others have learned. I have never gotten over the fact of how universal, not absolutely, I know that, I had the experience with a couple of guys, but how near universal the innate courage of those infantry guys was. one example of many. When I was wounded, I managed to drag myself onto the battalion objective, which was the line of the Haganah Forest, where there were Germans before we got there, and we disposed of them. This fellow named Benny Foster, very rough-hewn, good guy, and I had a runner, you know, I had somebody assigned to me with a little radio called a 536, Signal Corps 536, small, a little bit larger version of the kind of mobile phones that we see today. He was my runner, and he had the thing to keep in touch with the other outfit. And he made a cardinal error. We were under fire by mortars and snipers and riflemen and machine gunners. And I was, from my football playing days, I was zigging and zagging and making believe I could get away from the fire if I just zigged and zagged enough and fell and rolled and all the things we learned about how to evade fire. And this runner of mine made a cardinal error. We had never talked about it. But every time I would get up and run 10 yards or 12 yards and hit it and roll, he would, when I got up for the next one, he'd come and roll to the same place. And, you know, the snipers tried to get me because I was out front. And they made the assumption that the guy's out front, he's probably the platoon leader. And that's who they go after first. I heard his cry. And he had been hit by falling in the same spot that I would have been hit had I stayed there. But by the time they zeroed in, I was off running somewhere else. In any event, he was out in the field, and I didn't know if he was wounded, dead, what. And I had, by that time, been hit, and I was reorganizing the other platoons and so forth on the battalion objective. And I said to Benny Foster, I said, "Benny, so-and-so, whatever his name was, he's out there. Would you go out there and get him, because maybe he's alive again?" And Benny Foster put down his rifle against the tree and ran out under the fire, just like you see in the movies, zigging and zagging. He got to him, and like you see in the movies, he put him around his shoulders and carried him into the woods where we were. He stayed alive for a while, because as I was moving back in the course of the battalion aid station, the regimental aid station, and ultimately into a hospital, I kept checking on this young man, and a chaplain at the third place. He said, "I understand you're looking for so-and-so." I said, "No, I just want to know how he's doing." And he told me he died, so I knew he was gone. The point of that is, when I came back to the line some time later, spent 6 weeks in the hospital, I said to Benny Foster, I said, "Benny, you were just terrific. You know, I asked you to do something, to run out under the fire." I said, "Oh, forget it, Lieutenant, forget it." And he looked at me and he said, "You know, when you asked me to go out there that way, I almost said, 'Fuck you, Lieutenant.' Well, I didn't." So he had a moment of wondering why I would select him to put his life on the line to maybe save somebody, which he didn't save him, but he gave him a chance at least at survival. That little act that finished that anecdote about Benny Foster, many years later, it took about 50 years before I decided, you know, I'd love to meet some of my old buddies from combat. And I was going through the method one uses of trying to find somebody. And I got on the phone with somebody named Benny Foster and found it. Maybe he's the guy who I thought was from West Virginia. Was from Virginia. Anyway, a guy gets on the phone, and I said, "Is it Benny Foster?" And he says, "Yes, it is." I said, "Were you in the 143rd Regiment?" He said, "Oh, you're probably talking about my father. I had the same name as his father." I said, "Oh." He said, why are you asking? And I said, well, he was in my outfit, and I just was trying to find him. And I just wanted him to know how great he was. This kid almost died. He said, wait a moment. And he left the room, got back on the phone, and started reading a citation of that incident. When I came back, I put him in for a medal for putting himself under fire that way. And this guy is reading to me, and as he gets through the first or second line, I said, the next few lines, it came back to me what I had said about him. He said, how do you know that? I said, well, I wrote that citation when I put it in for your father. And then I said, well, where is he? And he said, well, about 6 years after he came back, he was a machine operator of some kind, and a piece of heavy machinery fell on him and killed him. So he had survived all that, and was killed in an industrial accident. But his son, who sends me Christmas cards every year, was so touched that, you know, that I was able to tell him, and knew the citation. The only trouble was, he said, so they gave him a bronze star? I said, they what? I had put him in for a silver star, you know, and they have like a quota system that can only be a certain number of bronze stars, I guess. But they gave him the bronze star, which I never knew about until then. Anyway, that's the story of Benny Foster, just one guy who put his life on the line for a fellow GI. My experience was that there were a lot of Benny Fosters, people who would put themselves on the, you know, on the spot and on the line to try to help somebody else. And that was I've never forgotten that. There is a natural, now that doesn't mean everybody, I can tell you about one guy who started sobbing in the woods, you gotta send me back. He said, I'm going crazy, you gotta send me back, you gotta send me back. And then I said, I'll tell you what I'll do instead. I handed him my binoculars. I said, I want you to find where that sniper fire is coming from. And I must say, basic psychology or something. By giving him a job to do, he stopped crying, stopped asking to be sent back, and did something affirmative. He was trying to find the sniper. Anyways, not everybody had the natural courage that the people did. There was a lot of it. A lot of it. Next.
Were you surprised by that kind of courage?
You know, I don't know. You just live it and you think about it. And, no, I didn't have any doubts. I didn't go around saying that everybody has to do something to do it. I mean, I'd say I wasn't surprised at the moment. I wasn't thinking whether I would do it, but it was done. And then reflecting upon it, it was my view that there was amazing readiness to try to help the next guy.
So, just for clarification, where was the 36th when you met up with them?
They were in France, in Alsace-Lorraine. The town that was the headquarters for that area for replacement people was Brumath. I don't know precisely what town they were. Of course, it's a division. You have three regiments. You have a weapons regiment, three infantry regiments, three rifle, if you will, regiments. I forget exactly what the headquarters was, but it was all in right after the combat, which was very severe that I lucked out. I wasn't part of that. In the Vosges Mountains, in the winter of 1944, it was some very, very tough fighting. I joined the division in February of 1945, so all I had to do was survive. I didn't know at the time for 4 or 5 months, and I would have made it through the war. And I was lucky enough to do that.
And what was the name of that forest that you mentioned?
Haganau, H-A-G.
H-A-G?
U-E-N-A-U, Haganau. Haganau Forest.
And many of the soldiers who are in the 36th, were many of them like you who are just coming in, or were many of them had come up all the way through France and Italy?
There were very few left who started out in the invasion Africa where they were trying to do the invasion of, in fact, some of them may have gone to Sicily as well, but they were part of the invasion at the Anzio beachhead, it's referred to, in southern Italy. And of those people, there were very few who had survived until I joined them. I told you about the one guy who refused to stay in charge of the platoon. There was another guy named, a perfect Texas name. He's gone now. Rufus Claghorn, that was his name. He was a major and had come, graduated Baylor University as an engineer. And Baylor is in Waco. And Waco was the headquarters of the 143rd Regiment when it was the National Guard out there. The regiment was there. And he got a battlefield commission. He went over as a corporal or a sergeant. And got a battlefield commission and survived. And I met him when I arrived, and they put me and others who had joined the outfit to a day or two of kind of frontline maneuvers to get us ready for frontline combat. And something about this redneck guy, so different in background than myself, but we hit it off. And he's a guy who survived all, and survived right to the end of the war. I got to tell the story because it's, you know, one out of a million. There was a moment in time after the war when I went back to college, and I was thinking about before I re-entered college. Came back in August, and I decided because of certain, I stayed in the occupation at the end of the war. I didn't have enough points. They had a point system. I didn't have enough points. You got 5 points for a combat medal. You got 2 points for every month in a combat area that you served, 1 point for just service, and if you had 75 points, you got sent home at the end of the war within a short period of time. I didn't have 75 points. I had my time in the service plus the time overseas plus the medals. And it got me to 68 or whatever it was, but I didn't have enough. And frankly, I was not displeased, because I'd only been over there about 5 months, and the idea of leaving after that short period really didn't intrigue me. The idea of staying and learning about Europe and having experiences post-war intrigued me, and so I stayed over there for about 14 months in the occupation. I noted, because I had combat, I was given a lot of deference. What kind of jobs I would do with the Constabulary Squadron, which was the part of the occupied force. It had been the 14th Armored Infantry Battalion, it became the 14th Constabulary Squadron. The 36th went home. There was some talk about the 36th being given some leave and going on to Japan, but luckily they were not to have to do that. But I decided that I'd seen so much, and I'm sorry to report this. Our country sent over civil government officers. These were people who were trained mostly in Washington to take over German villages and their county headquarters and so forth to govern, to provide civil government. And my work included a lot of very interesting stuff, but I ran into several who I found was so wrong for governing on behalf of our country. They, you know, one guy said to me, what good friends in the town of, what's it called, Bartenstein, a town called Bartenstein, that was a castle, and it was owned by the Hohenlohe family, which is part of the Hohenzollern royal. I will not go into that. That's for another interview. But I was put in charge of clearing out this castle so our men could be billeted there. And it was a very interesting experience. But they had such pull, a month or two after the war, that I was visited by an American major from the Civil Government. And he said, you were asking them to leave the castle. I said, yes. I'm giving them there was one wing of the castle that was devoted to the church. I said they'd stay there, there were rooms there, but the rest of the castle would be used instead of just lodging the townspeople of this place called Bartenstein. By the way, it was acting German Gauleiter, mayor of the town, when I asked him to give me the list of Nazis which we would displace first. And when I discussed his castle, when might that be available? He was so happy that I wouldn't be dislodging the townspeople. I would just be dislodging the family from their castle. And this guy says to me, you're really this American major. Lieutenant, you really, you know, you should treat these people nicely. They'll take you hunting and everything. And that line stays in my mind to this day. I should be nice to them because they'll take me hunting. They were members of the Nazi Party, which one had to be, I don't know. He was a paratrooper, a captain, in that invaded Crete, or dropped into Crete, which is an island in the Mediterranean. And I didn't owe them anything as a human matter, or owe them anything as a political matter, or diplomatic matter, and found a place right in their own castle for them to stay, etc., etc. I'll finish the story because it had a lot to do with it. I was thinking about how wrong we were treating them. Instead of treating them honestly and straight, but with a certain discipline, in accordance with rules set down by General Eisenhower, there were the Eisenhower Order Number 8, I forget it. Some of it we all had difficulty with non-fraternization. We weren't supposed to fraternize with the Germans, but that's difficult to do when you're 19 years old. In any event, I decided that the only way to beat that system is to join it and try to change it from within. So I had foreign service as a possible career. And I went to Georgetown University. Still had my uniform on. It was August of 1946. And I get to Georgetown. I'm looking on the bulletin board, knowing the odds are long that I can get in, but about 2 weeks before the first semester of Foreign Service. They have a Foreign Service school at Georgetown University, School of Foreign Service. And I'm looking at the bulletin board, and there's an announcement that the first meeting of the ROTC unit at Georgetown would be on September 5th or 6th or something like that. And the name at the bottom was Rufus Claghorn, Lieutenant Colonel Commanding. And I said to him, I said, oh my God, Rufus is here at Georgetown. I can't miss. what a character. He greeted me as if we were long lost brothers. I mean, he couldn't have been nicer. We're going to see the dean right away. Jesus, Stanley, what a good idea, blah, 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 blah. And I'm not using his Texan twang. And he took me to see the dean, Dean Walsh, who was off on a mission in Berlin. It was called the Berlin Airlift. And he and a professor from Columbia named Philip Jessup had been designated to go over and negotiate with the Russians and try to work out a deal or something. In any event, the assistant dean said, well, you certainly seem to have an interesting background, but just we have 1,000 waiting and we're starting the term and we can't do that. But if you'll consent and be patient, next year you've got a place here. By the time the conversation was over, the price had gone up. I would not be able to use any of my credits from City College. I'd have to start from scratch. And the notion of waiting another year, starting from scratch, set me back like 5 years from what would already be the case. So I didn't go to a little bit of Foreign Service school. But we'll get back to that. Mm-hmm. The attitude about Jews came up again. I said to Rufus, I said, listen, do you know you're in New York? He said, oh, I think I was there one time. I said, why don't you come up on me and have a weekend? I'd like you to meet my parents. Now, my father, when he heard that there was going to be a lieutenant colonel coming to visit us on West 83rd Street, one of the big moments of his life. Rufus came, and he had a meal with my mother and father. My father still spoke a little accent. And at some point, my father said, so, Colonel, what do you think of New York? And Rufus said, oh, it's a terrific place. Too many Jews, but it's a terrific place. Now, we had never talked about religion, not once. We were just friends, you know, and just friends. But my father took it all around.